Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Smart Money Circle show. I'm Adam Sarhan. With me today is Dan I, who's a partner and CIO at Fort Pitt Capital Group with $5.5 billion in assets under management. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time, and welcome to the Smart Money Circle.
Thanks for having me, Adam. It's great to be with you.
So, Dan, I always like to begin. Can you tell us a little about your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. And I'll give you kind of the Cliff Notes version, if that's okay. But, you know, I started in the industry back in the early 2000s. And like a lot of us, I started my career with a big bank. So I worked for JP Morgan for about 6 years out of college. And, I learned a lot of good experience, but I realized a lot of things about myself, you know, pretty quickly as well. I realized I wasn't going to be a salesman. I didn't want to be in the business of, you know, pushing investment products that somebody else had already, researched. You know, I really wanted to focus on portfolio construction and, you know, investment research. And I also figured out again pretty quickly that I was probably best suited for working for a smaller, more cohesive firm compared to a big bank. So in 2009, I went to work as a portfolio manager for, you know, I'll call it at the time at least, a startup, you know, multifamily office, really focusing on ultra high net worth clients. And I got to work with a lot of really, you know, interesting and high profile families. I learned from a really experienced investment team. The founder was and still is a very accomplished institutional investor, very strong track record. And I think a lot of his, you know, philosophy really rubbed off on me, as did the focus on, you know, the importance of fundamental research and making decisions.
I love it.
I learned
good
to really, you know, scale the business of working with ultra high net worth families. Every relationship is, you know, as complicated as a small corporation. And oftentimes, you know, you're dealing with a lot of, you know, legacy investments, you know, private equity, real estate, restricted stocks that often have a much bigger influence on the portfolio results than the decisions that the portfolio manager is making. So in 2014, I went to work for an RIA in Central Pennsylvania, you know, a firm with a really streamlined, scalable process. The owner of the firm, a gentleman by the name of Jeff Roop, still a very good friend of mine today, just a great business manager, really had the business structured the right way, right people in the right seat, just an extremely efficient process. And that really allowed me to focus on exactly what I wanted to do, portfolio, investment process, security selection, et cetera. So about 5 years ago, we merged with Fort Pitt Capital Group. And, you know, I'm very well aware that, you know, mergers don't always go extremely smoothly, but, you know, this one really did. And I think a big part of that was because, you know, both firms had a very similar investment philosophy and process. And after the merger, I really had the pleasure of working closely with a gentleman by the name of Charlie Smith, one of the founding partners of Fort Pitt and the longtime CIO. We meshed really well, thought about the world the same way. So after a few years of transition, you know, Charlie kind of eased into retirement. I stepped into the CIO role, and I guess, as they say, you know, the rest is history.
I love it. So Dan, perfect segue to my next question. Can you tell us a little about your investment strategy?
Sure, absolutely. And I think, you know, our strategy really, really starts with, you know, the financial planning work that our advisors do on behalf of our clients. So we use that information to develop and create, you know, a really well-structured investment plan, an asset allocation strategy for our clients. I'd say our approach is a little bit different in that, you know, we really base our allocation recommendations based on the client's cash flow. So we want to have enough exposure to low volatility asset classes like cash and bonds, you know, to meet, you know, 4 to 6 years of our clients, you know, cash flow needs if they're living off a portfolio or are going to be making that transition. And that really puts us in a position where, you know, we're not forced to sell, you know, stocks at depressed prices, even if we have, you know, a pretty severe, long-lasting, you know, market downturn. And then outside of those lower risk assets, you know, we want to be invested in the equity market. We want our clients to earn, you know, the equity premium, which we talk a lot about, which is just kind of a maybe a fancy way of saying that over a reasonable time horizon, you know, stocks are going to outperform lower risk assets like bonds. But that doesn't just happen. You know, it happens because the owners of good, well-run businesses are going to earn higher rates of returns than the lenders to those businesses for the bondholders. If a business can't pay, you know, their owners a higher rate of return, it's probably not going to be a good business that's going to be around for a really long time. So that equity premium is very real. We think it's very powerful to compound that over multiple decades, and we want to own that or earn that for our clients. So the advisors really focus on the planning work, the asset allocation plan, using our various investment strategies, and then our team really manages our investment.
Nice. So you mentioned earlier the bottom-up approach. You like the fundamental investing. Let's talk about risk. How do you manage risk, and what are some mistakes you see people make with respect to risk management?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, I'll start with the basics, right? And which are certainly important, you know, diversification across strategies, you know, including an allocation to some more, you know, I'll say defensive sectors that may not keep pace with the market when it's ripping higher, but does provide some protection when the sun isn't shining. You know, managing position sizes and then rebalancing. I also think that point I made about, you know, upfront doing the work to decide how much of the portfolio to allocate to those lower risk assets so that you're not forced to sell stocks at depressed prices during down point or downturns is really important. But, you know, a big belief of ours is that, you know, the biggest risk for investors is not volatility. You know, we know volatility is part of the game. Part of the process. It's a foregone conclusion that it's going to happen. And I know, you know, you talk a lot about this, Adam, but you know, markets have recovered from every period of volatility. You know, the biggest risk for investors is really overpaying for businesses or overpaying for the merchandise in your portfolio. And we saw a lot of those examples, right, in late 2021, early 2022, where investors were just over their skis in terms of exposure to, you know, the newer high profile, unprofitable, you know, more speculative technology companies that when they turned down, you know, didn't just drop 10 or 15%, they were down 70, 80, 90.
Right.
It's much more difficult to come back from those types of mistakes and miscalculations than it is to come back from a normal bout of volatility. So risk management, I think you focus on the things that you control, and a big one is valuation and not overpaying for
it. Let's talk about valuation, Dan, because I know valuation, like beauty, is very subjective, and it's a lot of time in the eye of the beholder. How would you, what are some metrics you use to determine whether a stock is overvalued or undervalued?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number there, Adam, and I think it's kind of a culmination of a bunch of different things. I mean, for us, it's certainly, you know, kind of starting with a PE valuation, right? And then I'm trying to put that into context, right? So in context of the sector, of their peers, in context of, you know, a 10-year history, is the stock, you know, cheap or expensive compared to its own valuation history? And then we look at a lot of other things as well, such as, you know, price to free cash flow. And then, you know, we want to have that in context of some other things as well. So we really like to invest in efficient businesses, which we measure by, you know, high levels of return on equity, high levels of return on invested capital. We look for expanding profit margins and also, you know, durable earnings growth. And we really drill down into trying to find companies that have, you know, really visible, highly recurring streams of revenue. So it's kind of a culmination of a lot of work, but you know, what we're looking for at the end of the day is a bit of a margin of safety, you know, when we step into their names. If we think the stock is worth, you know, 50, can we be patient enough to buy it at 40 and provide ourselves with that margin of safety?
Understood. I love that. So how about stops on the downside? Do you say, hey, it goes down 10%, 20%, 30, 40, 50, you mentioned you can't come back from a 70% decline. How do you handle that when the thesis is wrong and you want to, you know, adjust accordingly?
Yeah, well, I think what you said is really important. And it's, you know, we do a lot of work up front to really try to establish that thesis. And we don't like being, we're long-term investors, so you know, we don't typically react to market volatility or headlines or kind of knee-jerk reactions. But I think the key to being a good investor and having a disciplined process is knowing that when your thesis has been, you know, shot down in flames, that it's okay to move on. So we don't have a specific, you know, level where we pull the ripcord. And a lot of times, you know, if the thesis is still intact, you know, those downturns can be a great opportunity to add to positions at lower valuations. But you still, you know, to do that, you still need confidence in your thesis, the management team, and long-term vision for the company.
Understood. No, that makes perfect sense. How about some timeless lessons you've learned along the way that you'd like to share with the audience, please?
Sure. For me, in my role, you know, some of the things that I've learned would be that, you know, delegating and deferring decisions isn't just okay, but it's a really good thing. You know, I have a team of really smart, talented analysts and portfolio managers that I, you know, lean on heavily. And I've certainly learned the lesson that I'm not always going to be the best person, you know, to make the call in every sector, every holding in our portfolio. The real important part is making sure that you get that decision on the right person's plate.
Got it.
And I think the other thing too would be that, you know, it's sometimes hard to admit as an investment manager or portfolio manager, but the fact is we're not going to be right all the time, right? A great investor told me once that, you know, if a portfolio manager's right 60% of the time, they're going to do phenomenally well.
Yeah.
Yeah, when things do go wrong,
right?
You know, no excuses, no blames, no ducking the issue. You have to own it and take accountability. And if you don't do that, it's very hard to establish credibility with your team and your clients. And it's very difficult to have a very good, long-standing relationship if you don't have that level of credibility.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So let's talk about some timeless mistakes you see people made or you've made and how to avoid them.
Yeah, that's also a good question. You know, I think when I look at, you know, some of the classic mistakes that I see, I mean, I think there's the ones like making decisions based on short-term outcomes, you know, chasing the hot stock or the latest Wall Street fad. I know some of your previous guests have covered those, but you know, from what I've seen, it's not overly challenging for individual investors to pick good stocks, to select good investments, but it's often challenging for them to be, you know, disciplined enough to wait for that, I'll call it the intersection. You know, the intersection between, you know, a good company and a good price. And it often takes some patience and some discipline to wait for that intersection. And then also on the other side of the coin, you know, it's, you have to have that sell discipline. We work with a lot of, you know, bring on board a lot of new clients. We often see, you know, portfolios that are kind of just a collection of stuff, I'll call it, right? Where the investor hasn't been able to part ways with a stock or an investment. You know, either pull the ripcord when you're wrong or realize the company has reached full value and it's time to move on to another idea. So that sell discipline, it's tough. It's probably the toughest part of the business, but, you know, critically important to have that.
Got it. No, makes perfect sense. So how about, The best piece of advice you'd like to share with the audience or give your 30-year-old self?
Yeah. Can I do two?
Yeah, sure. You can give 10. There's no rules.
Yeah, I'd say one would be, you know, to really both understand and leverage your time horizon in your favor. You know, if you're an investor with, you know, a few decades before retirement and then 2-3 decades post-retirement, you know, you really need to understand how inconsequential whatever is happening in the market today will be to your overall outcome over the next 30 or 40 years, right? So a lot of the real risk for a lot of investors is having that long-term time horizon and then being too conservative because they're concerned about volatility. So as we all know, there's a huge difference between compounding returns at 4 or 5% versus 7 to 8% over, you know, 2, 3, 4 decades, right?
Yep.
I think that's one. And the other one I would just say is that, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, the saying that markets don't wait, right? We all know that we can't time equity markets, but I think that saying really puts it into context in terms of why you can't time equity markets, right? So something, you know, bad happens or a negative outcome in financial markets or the economy, the market prices that in, you know, very, very quickly. It discounts that bad news. It often overshoots to the downside, and then it starts to recover way before the problem or the issue or the big scary event is even close to being resolved. I mean, let's just look back at the savings and loan crisis or 08 and 09, right? Banks continue to fail 4 or 5 years after, you know, the market bottom.
Right.
So it tells us as investors, we don't have the luxury to sit on the sidelines and wait it out until the scary event is passed and we get the all clear signal.
Right.
It just doesn't. Volatility is part of the game. Investors should understand it, embrace it, and just learn to grapple.
Beautiful. Well, Dan, I love it. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak today. Congrats on your success, $5.5 billion. Hopefully next time we speak, you'll be at 10, if not more. And we'll hopefully have you on again soon.
Great. Thanks for your time, Adam. I appreciate it.
Thank you.